All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, March 2nd, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is 30 degrees under 2 feet of heavy, wet snow here in upstate New York. And yes, it had been 60 degrees for 3 days and beautiful. So we experienced spring very briefly and woke up to over 2 feet of snow this morning. And it looks like a winter wonderland out there. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? We titled the show Brain Flu, EEG Faces, Smell-O-Vision, AI Eyes, and IoT. And we looked at lots of things. There was that brain flu. They found out it this current H3N2 flu that's been going around that I was afflicted with for a couple weeks actually affects your hippocampus, that affects your memory and causes some issues. And I definitely had been feeling the impacts of that. But also, they have discovered using EEG, not just with fMRI, but EEG now, which they could do with $30 for some project that DARPA funded years ago, $30 to make a portable brain recorder and put them in all the schools and the homes. And they can literally suck faces that you've seen out of your head and reconstruct them on a computer screen with EEG. Also, Smell-O-Vision, they are looking. We read about that Kanuku chip where the guy had actually used some brain cells and put them into a computer chip. So the chip itself could sniff for bombs, and they were going to put it in bomb-sniffing drones and maybe even use them at the airports. AI eyes, I don't remember what that was. Hold on. We're going to have to figure out. AI eyes, there was a story about how AI is watching everything right now, and even though we don't know it, sooner enough, we're going to find out that that's what's going on because it's everywhere, and they are making end devices more intelligent on a daily basis. They're making these neuromorphic chips to put the intelligence at the edge, and that will become your Internet of Things. So where are we going to continue today? Well, I stumbled across some stuff yesterday that, of course, sent me down a rabbit hole like I used to do. Actually, I was pretty excited about that, but I had to try to figure out how to interleave that with some of the stuff I still had up here from Wednesday. So we're going to make a go of it. So there's a story that I had up here from Wednesday titled Rise of the Machines, AI Apocalypse, where robots take over and, quote, treat humans like guinea pigs. Uh-oh. Could become a reality, says experts. So it's not just going to be the lunatics in charge. It's going to be the robots that rise up and treat us like guinea pigs as well. And remember, as we get into these machines and we have these medical scans and our healthcare becomes more and more digitized and they get more and more data about every single one of us in their database, they're going to be able to collate, bag, and tag that data, compare and contrast, and figure out what's a baseline, what is normal, and when you are operating outside of parameters. And that's where the danger lies. The very real dangers posed by technology include rampaging robots and super intelligent AI that could turn against its masters. Well, like we haven't thought of that one before. science fiction movies have long portrayed a frightening world where robots take over and use humans as slaves, but the bleak dystopian vision seen in movies such as iRobot and Terminator may not be as far-fetched as it first appears, according to a string of experts. Futurologist Dr. Ian Pearson told The Sun, quote, "We'll have trained artificial intelligence to be like us, trained it to feel emotions like us, but it won't be like us. It will be a bit like aliens off of Star Trek, smarter and more calculated in its actions. It'll be insensitive to humans, viewing us as barbaric, and when it decides to carry out its own experiments with viruses that it's created, it'll treat us like guinea pigs." Kind of sounds like DARPA. This terrifying vision of the future isn't a fringe theory, but one that is gaining traction. We also have Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, They always throw Bill Gates' name in there. But when he came out and said, oh, the robots are going to kill us all, artificial intelligence is a danger, he said that half-heartedly. And then, of course, they had Mark Zuckerberg, which I don't ever remember. I remember Zuckerberg telling Musk that he was stupid for thinking that the artificial intelligence was going to kill us all. So recently, a report by 26 experts warned that our future is under the threat from AI, and more must be done to keep the world safe. The report titled The Malicious Use of Artificial Intelligence, Forecasting, Prevention, and Mitigation was compiled by representatives from Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute and Cambridge University's Center for the Study of Existential Risk. Attacks could range from weaponized drones to bots being used to distribute fake news. What? Does it really say that? Oh, yes. We're being attacked by fake news distributed on the internet by botnets, claimed its authors. And this especially is true now as technology is accelerating at a faster pace than ever before. We are already seeing more human-AI interaction than any time in the past because it's spying on you everywhere. Take a look around you. Digital assistants like Alexa and Siri are in our homes and the phones we carry with us. AI is also powering the future self-driving cars that are predicted to hit our roads as soon as 2025. And in some cases, the bots are already outsmarting humans. Last May, Google's AlphaGo triumphed over the world's champion at the Chinese board game of Go. And then in August, AI beat the world's best pros at the video game called Dota 2. We've talked about both of those instances. This isn't a new phenomenon either. AI has been wiping the floor with us puny humans for years now. And it actually says that. That was not my addition. Who can forget IBM's Watson beating out two champions to win the popular U.S. game show Jeopardy? Still, there are those who believe the technology's benefits far outweigh any negative, and that would include Microsoft founder Bill Gates, who claimed that AI can be our friend. Like I said, they always throw Bill Gates in there and saying, oh, be careful of AI, except Bill Gates was never really against AI. AI is just the latest technologies that allow us to produce a lot more goods and services with less labor, and overwhelmingly over the last few hundred years, that has been great for society until now. But this current breed of AI built by companies like Google, Microsoft, and Apple is not the type that experts are losing sleep over. Instead, they fear what these building blocks could lead to. Remember, we found out that they want to start now making all the AI research and the code secret to protect you from the rogue actors out there. The billionaire entrepreneur Elon Musk has repeatedly urged governments to start regulating AI, warning that it poses a fundamental risk to the existence of civilization. Musk's comments led to a public spat with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, who claimed that such a doomsday scenario was irresponsible to be squawking about it. Don't wake up the people. Shh, let us finish our plan. Meanwhile, in the most immediate future, there are also the risks of hackers. Oh, yes, those hackers under every bed manipulating systems that we're utilizing in our places of work. And last year, research by Deloitte suggested that 85% of UK businesses plan to invest in AI by 2020. But are there safeguards to keep these systems and our cyber infrastructure secure? Well, don't worry about that, because I saw a whole bunch of stories yesterday where they have just elevated cyber command and control that Keith Alexander used to be in charge of, that had branches in every arm of the military, and they elevated that up to a more important position so they can actually mobilize troops now around the world. Kind of a scary future if you think about it, all in the name of cybersecurity. And Dr. Pearson claims that people will always be on the hunt for flaws in software, but now they're going to turn the AI onto that as well. They have the AI Sentry developed out of Carnegie Mellon University, and I don't remember what that was called. Mayhem, I think, was the name of the software. And that is definitely the type of thing that rogue states and terrorists and actors are going to be interested in. They will try to find weaknesses and exploit them for their own purposes. Ultimately, the burden rests on its creator's shoulders. And the real risks with AI are entirely human. Misuses, wrong choices, bad design, and missed opportunities, as well as our corporate overlords. And if something goes wrong, it'll be the responsibility of ours. And the only threat to humanity is humanity itself. Yet the rest is science fiction. Well, I say that they are wrong. All right, so don't worry about AI going bad, because the minds behind AI are the danger. And that's what I would agree with. Killer robots remain a thing of a futuristic nightmare, and the real threat from artificial intelligence is far more immediate. As one of my favorite science fiction novelists, William Gibson, famously observed, he wrote The Neuromancer, a great book if you never read it. The future is already here. It is just not evenly distributed. I wish people would pay more attention to that adage whenever the subject of artificial intelligence comes up, says the author John Naughton. Public discourse about it invariably focuses on the threat or promise, depending on your point of view, of superintelligent machines, ones that display human-level general intelligence, like Ben Goetzel is touting, even though such devices have been 20 to 50 years away ever since we first started worrying about them. Well, they're not so much anymore. The likelihood of such machines still remains a distant prospect. A point made by leading AI researcher Andrew Ng, who is one of the most boring lectures I think we've ever played on the show. Sorry, Mr. Ng, who said that he worries about superintelligence in the same way that he worries about overpopulation on Mars. And again, some of these people who are developing this technology are downplaying it to the nth degree. I just saw something with Kurzweil the other day on stage saying that our current artificial intelligence, or maybe it was Michio Kaku, our current artificial intelligence has the intelligence of a cockroach right about now. But that seems about right to me. If one were a conspiracy theorist, wink, one might ask if our obsession with a highly speculative future has been deliberately orchestrated to divert attention from the fact that lower-level but exceedingly powerful AI is already here. Well, that's what I would say, but call me a conspiracy theorist. Paint me silly. And that playing an ever-expanding role in shaping our economies, our societies, and our politics. And that's right, we're going to have an AI for president one day. This technology is a combination of machine learning and big data, and it is everywhere, controlled and deployed by a handful of powerful corporations with occasional walk-on parts assigned to national security agencies. These corporations regard this version of quote-unquote weak AI as the biggest thing since sliced bread, and the CEO of Google burbles about AI everywhere in his company offerings. Same goes for other digital giants in the face of this hype onslaught. We saw that Amazon was actually coming out with their own neuromorphic chip now. It takes a certain amount of courage to stand up and ask awkward questions. Is this stuff so powerful? Then surely we ought to be looking at how it's being used, whether or not it's legal, ethical, and good for society, and thinking about what would happen if it gets into the hands of people who are worse than the folks who run the big tech corporations, because it will. Well, guys, start listening to the show, people at TheGuardian.com. Fortunately, there are scholars who have asked these awkward questions, and there are, for example, researchers who work at AI Now, which is a research institute at New York University focused on the social implications of artificial intelligence. In their 2017 report, it makes for interesting reading, and last week, it saw publication of more of the same vein, a new critique of the technology by 26 experts from 6 major universities, plus a number of independent think tanks and NGOs. Its title, called The Malicious Use of Artificial Intelligence, Forecasting, Prevention, and Mitigation, says it all, and the report fills a serious gap in our thinking about this stuff. We've heard the hype, corporate and governmental, about the wonderful things that AI can supposedly do, and we have begun to pay attention to the unintentional downside of legitimate applications of the technology. So now the time has come to pay attention to the real malign things bad actors, or they even use my phrase, could do with it. The report looks at 3 domains in which we can expect problems. One, of course, is digital security. And I just saw something about Baidu being able to use just 60 seconds of your voice now, not a minute, not 10 minutes like Adobe's Voco used to need. No, just 60 seconds of your voice to reproduce it in any way, shape, or form And then call your family members and tell them that you need ransom money or something. I don't know. It's pretty frightening thoughts. One is digital security. The use of AI to automate tasks involved in carrying out cyber attacks will alleviate the existing trade-off between scale and efficiency of attacks. We can also expect attacks that exploit human vulnerabilities, such as speech synthesis for impersonation, as well as existing software vulnerabilities through automated hacking, or vulnerabilities of legitimate AI systems, such as corruption of data streams on which the machine depends. The second threat domain is physical security. Attacks with drones and autonomous weapon systems. Think version 2.0 of the hobbyist drone that ISIS deployed, but this time with facial recognition on board. I've talked about that one quite a bit in the past. It's going to be connected to the cloud with 230-point facial recognition and bzz, 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 bzz. Oh, there she is. As you're running through the woods with a heat blanket over you trying to hide. We can also expect new kind of attacks that subvert physical systems, causing autonomous vehicles to crash, let's say, like that hasn't happened before, and ones deploying physical systems that would be impossible to remotely control from a distance, and there would be a 1,000-strong swarm of micro-drones, like that one, what were they called, Slaughterbots, for example, that could target people based upon the dissent they posted on social media and then take them out. Finally, there is what the author calls political security, and they'll be using AI to automate the tasks involved in surveillance, persuasion, creating targeted propaganda and deception, and they'll be manipulating videos or audio, making people say and do things that they never really did to sway your opinion. We can also expect these new kinds of attacks based on machine learning's capabilities to infer human behaviors, moods, and beliefs from available data. And that's what I've been saying about this whole brain initiative and getting into the machine and letting them scan you and doing behavioral monitoring and wearing your $30 EEG in school, Johnny, so they can tell what makes you tick. Because they will be able to replicate that, and they'll be able to diagnose you long before you have any future issues. Pre-crime. This technology will obviously be welcomed by authoritarian states, but it'll also further undermine the ability of democracies to sustain truthful public debates, and it'll also erode away at your freedoms, I'm going to add. The bots and fake Facebook accounts that currently pollute our public sphere will look awfully amateurish in a couple of years, and the report is available as a free download and worth reading in full. If it were about the dangers of future speculative technologies, then it might be reasonable to dismiss it as academic scaremongering. But the alarming thing is that most of the problematic capabilities that the authors envisaged are already available and in many cases currently embedded in many of the networking services that we use every single day. William Gibson was right. The future has already arrived and they've been telling you, shh, don't pay attention because it's not happening fast. I mean, I know we've been saying that, but don't listen to them because that's fake news. Well, if you've been listening to the show, you've seen it as we've been going through 6-7 years now. I don't know how long I've been doing this. And we've been stepping through the steps to get where we are today. Stuff that we talked about 5-6 years ago is actually happening now. And this is going to keep coming at us full frontal. Remember the law of accelerating returns. As things start building on things that are using machines to build the next generation, it's going to accelerate even more. So, all right, where do we go from here? So let's sign right up. Good old Ottawa. Ottawa, Canada is becoming a hotbed for artificial intelligence. An Ottawa company is developing a quote-unquote mood ring for your brain. Did anybody have a mood ring in the 70s? I know my mother had a mood ring, and I found it one time going through her jewelry box and put it on. It was pretty damn cool. But now there is a mood ring for your brain. We have actually, I think the repeat that I ran yesterday, we talked about that emotive software. You put on this little headset and it can actually read your mood and whether or not you're depressed by looking at the frequency of your brainwaves. Then you could dial up or dial down your mood. Well, here we go. It might sound like science fiction, like a lot of this crap we look at every single day, but a brain-sensing emoji generator built by Ottawa's Personal Neurodevices is very much for real. Just think of it as a mood ring for your brain. Brainmoji is a smartphone app that uses sensors in a headset to turn your moods into a symbol, and it is the brainchild of local tech developer Steve Dennison. We are very much at the prototyping stage at this point, and then beyond that, we will need to build marketing distribution and all the functions that are required to take the company from early stage to emerging. And Ottawa is not the worst place to be to do that, no, because there's a lot of startups. And I thought there was an Israeli company that we had read about at one point that was doing the very same thing, where it could rate your phone calls based upon the sound of your voice and give you a smiley face or an unhappy face every time you talk to your mother or your nana. But funding to develop a concussion technology is tight, because that's where their initial research started. So they decided to transfer the research into a consumer application instead, where they can make bazillions of dollars. And they now hope to build a profile and attract some initial investment. And they started a crowdfunding campaign with an initial goal of $50,000. And then eventually plan to resume their research into brain injuries so they could diagnose the children who've had injuries while playing football. And I think that's the next story. And this headset that is called the Spark uses four sensors to pick up the brain's activity using, oh, what? EEG. So let's put on our EEG sunglasses, our $30 headsets, or our little emoji cons and see what it can tell us, and then send it to some data center in the cloud. The sensor sends the information via Bluetooth to the app, which then converts the information into an emoji with pretty colors of the rainbow that reflects the wearer's mood while they type. They believe that the idea will take off once people warm up to the concept of having their brain scanned. And he says he would love to see this technology complement something like Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, and iMessage. The first foray into neuroscience came in 2000, and anticipating the tech sector crash, Dennison divested himself and his tech holdings and returned to the university, where he took a psychology course and learned about EEGs and brain imaging, right, all to capitalize on the coming brain scanning, everybody. All the while, smartphones were getting smarter and EEGs were becoming more available and cheaper, and he saw the convergence coming. Dennison is cautiously optimistic about his technology being used for other purposes, such as helping people with difficulty communicating to expressing themselves. Of course it is. And certainly the headset that we've built is ideally suited for that kind of application. So step right up. Get your EEG, because they're cheap now, and they're rolling out into consumer devices that can show you things like pretty colored smiley and unhappy faces. Well, here is a news story. Precrime, they have now discovered that up to 60% of all prisoners in jails have head injuries in the past, and experts warn that brain damage may fuel crime. So step right up, little Johnny, in second grade. Become a STEM scientist. Get your $30 DARPA-funded EEG done, and let's find out if you're going to become a future criminal because you fell down while playing football. More than half of the criminals in the world have suffered a head injury, which could be fueling their offending, a new review by British brain experts suggest. Specialists from the universities of Oxford, Exeter, Manchester, Glasgow, and Sheffield, as well as the Center for Mental Health, are calling for all prisoners to be routinely checked for signs of traumatic brain injury. The comprehensive review published in the Lancet Psychiatry suggests that bumps to the head from falls, assaults, or road accidents could lead to neural injuries, which alter the brain structure and increase the risk of violence offending. The author claims that up to 60% of people in custody have suffered some kind of head injury in the past, ranging from mild to severe. And in contrast, around 200 people in the general public have been admitted to a hospital for head injuries, according to the charity called Headway. The experts say that helping prisoners receive proper treatment could prevent their future offending, and they've called on schools, doctors, hospitals to help them identify the youngsters, oh no, who have suffered head injuries before they can commit a crime. Addressing traumatic brain injury often means to not only improve the lives of those who offended, but also to reduce crime, says our future pre-crime overlords. And a range of measures could reduce the risk of crime following brain injury. These could include any form of neurorehabilitation. So let's put them in an asylum for a while and zippity-zap them. And better links between emergency departments, community mental health services, general practitioners, and school systems that might lead to early identification and management. It is also thought that head injuries damage parts of the brain responsible for self-regulation, impulse control, and pro-social behavior. And links to violence and head trauma date back to the Vietnam War, when it was noted that veterans who would suffer brain injuries to the front of their heads, that would be the area involved in planning, decision-making, and emotional regulation, became far more aggressive. And some of Britain's most notorious criminals, include Fred West and Ronnie Cray, are also notably suffered head injuries. One of the consequences of head injury is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And studies have shown that treatment for ADHD leads to reduction in criminality. Of course, get little Johnny on his Adderall. And that's down to reducing the aggression. So treating symptoms like that could help. This is horrifying, people. They want to come after your kids. They want to get everybody bag tagged and scanned so then they can predictively manage you in the future. For some people, and not that I'm saying don't get treated if you have a head injury of some kind, but I'm just saying that this is what happens when they start collating data. They come up with these correlations that they can say, well, hey, almost everybody in jail who's had a head injury becomes violent, becomes a future criminal. So for some people, serious and repeated head injuries, particularly those in early life, have been associated with an increasing risk of offending alongside a range of other difficulties, including poor mental health. And identifying those who have emotional or cognitive difficulties resulting from a brain injury may help to ensure that they get the right support to improve their mental health and potentially reduce their risk of later offending. This just keeps going on and on. We get the gist. However, some of the effects of brain injury, such as memory loss, increased impulsivity, anger, and reduced inhibition, can lead people into difficulty with the law. And evidence suggests overrepresentation of brain injury in offender populations. It is vital that we better identify brain injury at the earliest possible stage in the criminal justice system. So let's turn all the teachers and the doctors into government snitches so they can report all the kids who get bumps on the head. We can put them into the future offender database. So, all right, where do we go from here? I had actually a whole show lined up I was going to do today, but then a lot of these stories were pretty good that I had lined up from Wednesday, so we went backwards. Microsoft, so this is another one of the big boys getting into the fray, predicts that everyone will soon have an AI second self to boost their intelligence. And we've talked about mind file uploads. We've talked about 3D printing stem cells to make body parts and clones. Well, a new book by two industry titans predicts that in the near future, everyone will have a digital alter ego. The book, titled The Future Computed, comes from Microsoft's president, Brad Smith. I don't know who he is. And an EVP of AI and research named Harry Shum. In this freely available and worth checking out look into what's around the bend, the two argue that the companies have embraced AI if they want to be successful going forward, but progress can move faster if researchers do not sit on the knowledge that they are developing, but sharing it with their competitors, ensuring that AI will reach its full potential. Well, we read a story that went against that on Wednesday about how they're thinking that by sharing their research, it's going to give all of the information to the rogue actors and make AI even more dangerous than it already is. So let's keep it all secret. One big AI advancement that the two tech gurus predicted will be created within the next 20 years is the advent of digital assistants. And we're not talking about current versions of Siri, Cortana, or Alexa, but assistants that control all aspects of your life. And let's say that again. Assistants that control all aspects of your life. knowing everything about you, but with your permission, of course. And internally, Microsoft uses the words alter ego or second self to describe the kind of amazingly sophisticated digital help that you'll be getting. Here, just tip your head forward, Johnny. It won't hurt a bit. We're going to connect this right to the back of your spine, at the base of your brain, and it'll be able to record everything that you've ever done and keep track of it. I think that was like a Black Mirror episode where they had the little memory chip behind the ear. Another interesting point the tech giants make involves the importance of humanities. The author's purpose that once AI is close to being given decision-making responsibilities, researchers with backgrounds in humanities will be needed to guide AI to become more human. And I'm one of those people with a background in humanities. Like, it is thinking. Tech companies, that's why I look at ethics a lot, but not just technology, because there are a lot of issues with ethics going on right now. Tech companies can help create the tools, but how society uses them should be a much broader part of the conversation, right? We shouldn't be striving to be gods. Smith and Shum also highlight the significance of starting to discuss and coming to a consensus on the ethics of artificial intelligence. What are some of the abilities of your future digital alter ego may have? Well, while Microsoft hasn't necessarily shared many details of their plans, other industry insiders have some ideas. And for one, our communication with such an assistant would likely be conversational. And instead of talking out loud, the interaction might take place entirely inside of your head. Oh, God. Elon Musk is betting on that kind of future as well. If you can't beat him, join him. And he's founded Neuralink to create a brain-computer interface to connect us to the machine so we do not become AI's pets. Another advance to looking forward, the AI second self will likely make you much smarter and much sexier, says Kurzweil. And it will not only be able to keep track of where you go, but who you need to see, what pill you need to take, and order things for you based on just what you are thinking. Oh, yeah, that could be dangerous. Oh, I need a new Lamborghini. but it will be an inexhaustible supply of immediate available information, calculations, and well-informed decisions for you to make. And yes, we're going to put the internet into your brain, Johnny, so you don't even have to carry around that surveillance device anymore. It'll be connected to you 24/7. An AI layer will be, quote, amplifying human ingenuity in untold ways. And if we don't get enslaved or somehow destroyed by AI, as Elon Musk and other experts often caution, a future with a digital second self is certainly, says this author, worth looking forward to. Well, so says you. So says not me. All right. So if this page alone... Hopefully I don't have to sing the happy elephant. Oh, come on. Cancer-fighting nanobots talking about artificial intelligence inside of the body to seek and destroy tumors. This is a new story out of Arizona State University, February 12, 2018. Study shows the first applications of DNA origami for nanomedicine. We first read about DNA origami robots out of the Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering. That is a collaboration between, if I'm not mistaken, MIT and Harvard, and Georgie Porgy Church kind of steps over there every once in a while, and that was the home of the RoboBees. In a major advancement in nanomedicine, Arizona State University scientists, in collaboration with researchers from the National Center for Nanoscience and Technology and the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and that's what scares me. We keep reading here. Every time we're reading about some of these new technologies, there seems to be a Chinese institution involved as well. They're not our enemies, guys. They are working right in step with us for this enslavement of humanity. Has successfully programmed nanobots to shrink tumors by cutting off their blood supply. Oh! So think about this, double-edged sword. Sure, they can go in and cut off the blood supply to tumors, but it probably could also go in and cut off the blood supply to your brain if they wanted it too. We have developed the first fully autonomous DNA robotic system for a very precise drug design and targeted cancer therapy, says Hao Yan, director of the ASU Biodesigns Institute Center for Molecular Design and Biomimetics and the Milton Glick Professor in the School of Molecular Sciences. Moreover, this technology is a strategy. Oh, yes, it is. That can be used for many types of cancers, since all solid tumor-feeding blood vessels are essentially the same. Yes, or blood vessels that feed blood into the brain. And successfully demonstrating this technology at the first-of-its-kind study in mammals utilizing breast cancer, melanoma, ovarian, and lung cancer models, it was published in the Journal of Nature Biotechnology. Yan is an expert in the field of DNA origami, which in the past two decades has developed atomic scale manufacturing to build more and more complex structures. And the bricks that build their structures come from DNA, which can be self-folded into all types of shapes and sizes, all at a scale of 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. In hopes of one day revolutionizing computing, electronics, and medicine, and giving everyone a nanite or a bunch of nanites that can live in your bloodstream and cure you at the drop of a hat. One day, it might be coming a bit faster than anticipated. Did you hear that? Yeah, it's coming faster than we ever imagined. Nanomedicine is a new branch of medicine that seeks to combine the promise of nanotechnology to open up an entirely new avenue for treatments, such as making minuscule molecule-sized nanoparticles to diagnose and treat difficult diseases, especially cancer. But until now, nobody knew it was getting inside their bodies without their knowledge. But hey, we're going to talk about that. The challenge to advancing nanomedicine has been difficult because scientists wanted to design, build, and carefully control nanobots to actively seek and destroy cancerous tumors while not harming, wink, any healthy cells. The international team of researchers overcame this problem by using a seemingly simple strategy to very selectively seek and starve out tumors. But the work was started about 5 years ago, and the researchers specifically wanted to cut off blood to a tumor. And by inducing blood coagulation, ding-a-ling-a-ling, with high therapeutic efficacy and safety profiles in multiple solid tumors using DNA-based nanobots, they were very successful. And you know, what kind of gets me about that is back when I had my stroke, there was one thing that I'd seemed to see a big spate of, and people that I knew, like all kinds of people who never were really ill much before, all were having these weird strokes with blood clots. Well, and I was at that time postulating as to whether or not they could coagulate blood with radio frequencies. But look at little mini nanobots. They can do blood coagulation and make blood clots with DNA-based nanocarriers. Professor Hao Yang's, and I'm not saying that was what happened, but I'm just saying, look, there's a double-edged sword, and they most certainly could turn these into little mini assassins if they wanted to. Professor Hao Yan's expertise has upgraded the nanomedicine design into a fully programmable robotic system able to perform its mission entirely on its own. So it's fully autonomous. Don't let these suckers get out of the lab. These nanobots can be programmed to transport molecular payloads and cause on-site tumor blood supply blockages, which can lead to tissue death and shrink the tumor, as well as kill your brain or cause memory deficits. And to perform their study, the scientists took advantage of a well-known mouse tumor model where human cancer cells are injected into the mouse to induce aggressive tumor growth. Poor little mousies. Once the tumor was growing, the nanobots were deployed into the mouse and came to the rescue. And each nanobot is made from a flat rectangular DNA origami sheet, 90 nanometers by 60 nanometers in size. And a key blood clotting enzyme called thrombin is attached to the surface. Oh, these guys are evil. This is beyond evil. This is a little nanobot assassin. Sure, it's going to cure your cancer, but it also can kill anyone that we want to, that gets infected with these things. Thrombin can block tumor blood flow by clotting the blood within a vessel that feeds the tumor or the brain, caused by a sort of tumor mini heart attack and leading to tumor tissue death. First, the average of 4 thrombin molecules was attached to a flat DNA scaffold, and next, the flat sheet was folded in on itself like a sheet of paper into a circle to make a hollow tube. Then it was injected with an IV into a mouse and then traveled through the bloodstream, homing in on tumors. The key to programming a nanobot that only attacks cancer cells was to include a special payload on its surface called a DNA aptamer. And the DNA aptamer could specifically target a protein called a nucleoin that is made of high amounts only on the surface of tumor endothelial cells and not found on the surface of healthy cells. Once bound to the tumor blood vessel's surface, the nanobot was programmed like a notorious Trojan horse. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, because that is my point exactly, to deliver its unsuspecting drug cargo into the very heart of the tumor, exposing an enzyme called thrombin that is a key to blood clotting. And if I'm not mistaken, thrombin also exists in foods such as broccoli and spinach. And if you've had a stroke and you're taking anticoagulants, you should be very careful. Though I love my broccoli and my spinach, those are two of my favorite dark greens, but you should be very careful because they do include thrombin and they do help the blood to clot. The nanorobots worked very fast, congregating in large numbers to quickly surround the tumor just hours after injection. And first and foremost, the team showed that the nanorobots were safe and effective in shrinking tumors. The nanobots proved to be safe and immunologically inert for use in normal mice and also in miniature pigs, showing no signs of detectable changes in normal blood coagulation or cell morphology. Most importantly, there was no evidence of the nanobots spreading to the brain, which could cause unwanted side effects such as what? Oh, yes, a stroke, like I said. And we found out the other day on Wednesday that scientists have now admitted that they don't really understand that blood-brain barrier as much as they thought they had, because things have been crossing that blood-brain barrier, such as that gadolinium or whatever it was, which was that MRI contrast dye, and it's depositing itself in a lot of our organs that they thought it was actually being eliminated from the body. The nanobot proved to be safe, and make sure it doesn't get to the brain because it could cause a stroke. But the nanobots are decidedly safe in normal tissues, and the treatment of a tumor's blocked blood supply caused it to kill the tumor. And within 24 hours, they were having no effect on healthy tissues. After attacking the tumors, most of the nanobots were cleared and degraded from the body within 24 hours, or so they say. Remember, like that gadolinium, and then also like nanoparticles, they don't typically flush out of the body, but they tend to group in some of your organs, like your spleen and your liver. And by 2 days, there was evidence of advanced thrombosis, and 3 days, thrombi of all tumor vessels were observed. I would rather take curcumin to cause apoptosis of the tumor. The key is to trigger thrombin only when it is inside of the tumor blood vessel. And also in melanoma mouse models, 3 out of 8 mice receiving the nanorobot therapy showed complete regression of the tumors, and the mean survival time has more than doubled, extending from 20.5 to 45 days. They also had tried their system in a test of a primary mouse lung for cancer, which mimics the human clinical course of cancer patients, and they showed shrinker of the tumor tissue after a 2-week treatment. Guys, this is really horrifying that they are pushing this stuff, and this is going to become the new treatment model for humans. So step right up and get your little DNA cancer killing nanobots, because it's all for your benefit. But remember the very first story we read, that AI, when it gets smarter than us, is going to treat humans like guinea pigs. Well, if this wasn't guinea pig-ish, I don't know what is. Jan and his collaborators are now actively pursuing clinical partners to further develop this technology. Oh, yay. The thrombin delivery DNA nanobot constitutes a major advance in applications of DNA nanotechnology for cancer therapy. I think that we are much closer to real, practical medical applications of this technology and combinations of differently, rationally designed nanobots carrying various agents may help to accomplish the ultimate goal of, yes, human domination. No, it doesn't say that. The ultimate goal of cancer research, and that would be the eradication of solid tumors and the vascularized metastases. And remember, guys, way back when we first started talking about nanobots 6-7 years ago, and everyone would look at me with a raised eyebrow and go, yeah, Joel, you're kind of touched in the head. One of the things we had discussed is at that time, nobody that I knew, nobody would have said, yes, I'm going to step right up for my nanobot delivery. But one of the things we had postulated was the way they would convince the general public to step up for this would be to cure the Big C, because the Big C has been one of those things that they've been promising forever and ever. And this is our not-too-distant science fiction future. The current strategy may be developed as a drug delivery platform to give you little nanobots for the treatment of other diseases by modifying the geometry of the nanostructures and targeting groups and the loaded cargoes. All right. Well, I have another story on that, but I think I'm going to skip that one because it's already, I got 10 minutes. So we're going to start getting into our next topic about nanoparticulates and CRISPR. Not, now remember, Georgie Porgy Church and his CRISPR, and they've been doing all kinds of crazy experiments. Not just gene editing. CRISPR toolkits have now expanded with a new trio of tricks. Now, if you guys remember, back at the end of last year, there was a story out of MIT Technology Review that we covered on the show, and it was titled, 5 Ways to Get CRISPR into the Body. And, of course, that caught my attention, because I've been saying from the very beginning that, yeah, this stuff, the splicing and dicing our DNA on the fly in vivo, is not going to be limited to lab animals. It is going to include you and me. But they got to get it into us because most people aren't going to step right up for this. So there's got to be tricky ways to get it inside of our bodies. Well, one of the ways, of course, would be creams. They have a thing now going on in China for curing HPV. And that would be the same target that Gardasil that causes more cancers is targeting. But they're going to want to splice and dice for HPV so it can go into the virus and snip, snip, snip and make it kill itself. They also are predicting there will be an edible CRISPR pill that can go in and it'll be all in the name of antibiotic resistance. You can now take your CRISPR pill when you have something like MRSA and it'll go in and make fatal cuts to the bad bacteria's DNA and cause it to commit suicide. They're also talking about ear injections. They've found that CRISPR and CRISPRing some of those cells inside of your ear can help reverse deafness. And they are also discussing skin grafting for people who have things such as diabetes, where CRISPR can go in and snippity snip and make you all better. So, all right, Singularity Hub, new one, brand new story, February 27th, 2018, not just gene editing, CRISPR toolkits expand with a trio of new tricks. So it's not just snippity snip anymore. CRISPR, the superhero of gene editing, just got a little more super, says Singularity Hub. In a trio of studies released last week in Science, leading CRISPR labs around the world unveiled some ultra-creative additions to the technique, transforming the hotshot editor into a virus detective and a sharp-eyed historian jotting down a cell's entire history into DNA. And we actually read about that one. I think that was the camera where you could take snapshots. Like CRISPR, these new technologies are dubbed with cute acronyms such as CAMRA, and that was the one I just mentioned, DETECTOR, and the third one is called SHERLOCK. The sudden explosion of outside-of-the-box uses of CRISPR clearly shows that scientists have become mad and are far from done exploring all of the mad science potential applications that the technology has to offer. To turn CRISPR into a true multi-tool, the team got creative. CAMRA, which is the cell recorder, uses rings of DNA, just like in a tree, is a readout for the cell's history, say, an exposure to antibiotics or toxins. And remember, there was a program also going on at DARPA where they were hoping to be able to scan a person's DNA to tell whether or not they had been exposed to some sort of pathogen, whether or not they had been, genetically modified, or whether or not they had used some sort of bioterror agent. Sherlock, in contrast, added a sacrificial RNA molecule that chops itself up in the presence of a virus or cancer DNA to create a positive signal. This shows up as a blue line on a paper strip, much like a pregnancy test. Then there's the cell recorder. Airplane black boxes are a precious resource for investigations when a flight goes awry or crashes into the ocean. Similarly, scientists have long hoped for a cellular time machine that details events in a cell's life, and that would be your doses of radiation over a lifetime, the sprinkling of drugs in your body, or bouts of internal turmoil that have pushed a healthy cell toward a diseased state. What's a better way to record a cell's history rather than DNA? Well, at Harvard University, who would have guessed it? Dr. David Liu took advantage of CRISPR's accurate DNA snipping ability and developed a molecular historian, which they called CAMRA. Short for CRISPR-mediated analog multi-event recording apparatus. And here's how it works. First, in bacterial cells, the team tweaked CRISPR's guiding molecule, that would be the guide RNA, so that it only kicks into action after a trigger, let's say an antibiotic or a chemical attack. And once active, the RNA guide beckons Cas9, which are the CRISPR scissors, to target the location. No guide RNA, no chopping action. And in addition to the modified CRISPR system, the team also gave two extra bits of DNA encoded into circular DNA called plasmids. Now, this sounds like stuff that DARPA's been working on, guys. This is going to genetically modify you in the case of a bioterror attack to make you immune or to cure you, all in name of your safety. Normally, the cell is expressed by the two plasmids at a steady ratio, and once the guided RNA is activated and the Cas9 goes after it, only after the plasmid sees it and chews it up, but it leaves the other intact. In this way, the team can easily measure the ratio of the two plasmids. And this is getting a little bit technical, and this is getting off the topic. So unlike previous generations of cellular recorders, Liu's system is highly sensitive, needing only about a dozen cells to generate a strong signal. Scribe, which is a similar recorder developed by Timothy Liu at MIT back in 2014, requires orders of magnitudes more cells with a poorer signal-to-noise ratio. Liu is impressed, and the new work, he says, is really beautiful stuff, quote-unquote, and an important advance. Two additional studies explore ways to turn CRISPR into a sensitive one-step diagnostic tool. Detector takes advantage of Cas9's famous cousin, Cas12, and like Cas9, Cas12 follows a guided RNA toward a target and then cuts it all up. But the scissors don't stop there. A team led by Jennifer Doudna, who is a co-founder of CRISPR with Georgie Porgy Church, who is a CRISPR pioneer at UC Berkeley. Sorry, guys, I'm still a little scratchy. Surprisingly found that Cas12 remains active after chopping up its intended target, so it doesn't shut off and immediately hunts down a single-stranded DNA molecule for destruction. So tapping this particular activity, the team added molecular neon signs to their guided RNA, which begins to glow bright green once Cas12 activates. And I thought there was something with the in vitro or in EQ fluorescence that Church was working on. And in a proof of concept, and they engineered several guided RNAs, blah, 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 blah. So based on the systems first developed in 2017, Sherlock, which is specific high sensitivity reporting and unlocking, uses a Cas13 as a tool where they add another little strand. Cas13 also has a wild streak going into overdrive after it demolishes its initial target. Yeah, like I want that inside of me. Sherlock 2.0, published online last week in Science, is 100 times more sensitive than the original. So let's get excited now. And it can detect up to four different targets at once. Like Detector, this makes Sherlock especially useful during outbreaks, so step right up, because it's going to be mandatory when you are in quarantine. And the tech can be easily modified to track other DNA molecules in your blood, for example, and those normally associated with cancer and aging. Together, these studies add to a growing research trend keen on exploring CRISPR technologies beyond your gene therapy. And compared to CRISPR-based therapeutics, which requires years of rigorous safety and efficacy testing, these alternative uses, wink, may quietly enter the scientific and diagnostic mainstream on a much faster timescale now that that pesky FDA is totally out of the way and we have the 21st Century Cures Act, all in the name of making you better. I mean, guys, I don't even know what to say to any of this because they are pushing this to the nth degree. And I really, truly think that they're going to pull out the pandemic card out of their sleeve one day and say, oh, now we have to cure everybody because there is no other way. This is some sort of rogue actor who has just developed something. And the only way to do this is to create some sort of genetically modified CRISPR editing. I'm trying to find my last story here that first got me down the path of looking. Here we go. This is where we're going to end the show today, and we're going to begin on Wednesday next week. It is titled, A Single Administration of CRISPR-Cas9 Lipid Nanoparticles, more affectionately abbreviated as LNP, achieves robust and persistent in vivo, and that would be inside the body, genome editing. What? Our work demonstrates that this lipid nanoparticle system can deliver CRISPR-Cas9 components to achieve clinically relevant levels of in vivo genome editing. Now, lipids, of course, are fats. And as I dug more into this lipid nanoparticle delivery, I was very shocked to see that they can make it in a nanoemulsion and use all different kinds of fats and additives to encapsulate these nanoparticles so it doesn't alert the body once they've gone in and cause an immune reaction. So they could slip it in your body and maybe put it into food as a nutraceutical. And I have stories on that as well. We're going to look at Wednesday. So the development of a clinically viable delivery method of a lipid nanoparticle presents one of the greatest challenges in the therapeutic application of CRISPR-Cas9 mediated genome editing in vivo. Here we report on the development of a lipid nanoparticle mediated delivery system that with a single administration enabled significant editing of a mouse.